Welcome to the second audio pod from the series of public lectures organised by World Rights London Behind the Scenes programme. This lecture is entitled Race, Immigration and Multiculturalism in Britain. The speaker is Munira Mirza, who writes, lectures and broadcasts on issues related to cultural policy, race and identity.
The East End is really at the heart of lots of the debates that I'm going to look at, and I'll speak generally about the national context in the UK, but I'll try and bring in a few examples from around here. Migrants, i.e. people who are born outside Britain, who are living here, are about 7.9% of the UK population. It's actually quite a small figure when you think about how obsessed we all are about immigration. The largest groups tend to be Indians, Pakistanis and Black Caribbeans. So there's obviously a relationship with the former colonies of Britain. What lots of people don't know is that during the 1980s, the largest immigrant groups were from the USA, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa, i.e. they were white immigrants. So the whole issue of colour, coloured immigration, is the thing that dominates the media, but actually it was white immigration. And today in London, the largest number of illegal immigrants tend to be white people, so, you know, the bar staff from South Africa. Those are the people, actually, that make up the numbers. And also importantly, almost a third of migrants arrived in the last decade. So the real push in the numbers for immigration is relatively recent. And the 1990s saw increases, particularly from Eastern Europe and also from various war-torn countries, Iraq, Somalia and so on. And importantly for this lecture tonight, more than 40% of migrants live in London. So London, the cities really are the places where migrants live. But East London in particular is a centre, is a hub for immigration and has been historically. This is 59 Brick Lane, a symbol of the successive waves of immigration in East London. So 59 Brick Lane started off in 1743 as a Huguenot church. 1809, it became the Jewish chapel, which was to convert Jews to Christianity. 1819, it became a Methodist chapel. 1897, it became the Spitalfields Great Synagogue. So you see that different groups are taking over at different times. And then 1976, it becomes the mosque, the Brick Lane Mosque in the area. So you've got this very concrete example of how East London is really home to waves of immigration. And this is just a picture of a scene that lots of you might already be familiar with, the Battle of Cable Street, which is a very famous moment in East London history where Oswald Mosley's fascists were trying to walk down the street and they were met by an army of working class, left-wing, trade unionists, communists and so on. It was seen as a kind of real clash and a real symbol of kind of political activity of the area. And the fact that race has always been quite explosive in East London because large groups of immigrants settled here, because it was relatively affordable housing, it was quite close to work. So East London has a very good place to think about when we think about race and immigration. I just want to talk very briefly about some of the historical factors that have shaped racial thinking and ideas about race in Britain generally. It's worth thinking through the narrative of how we've come to our thinking about race today and the different forms in which we've thought about race in the past and how it compares. So if we take as our starting point modernity, by which I mean the 18th and 19th century, where ideas about race become quite formalised, quite systematised, we start talking about race a bit more, then there are certain key factors that have influenced that. The first is obviously the slave trade, which Britain was involved with. 2 million Africans were shipped over the Atlantic to America, and the system of slavery coincides and is justified by an ideology of race, i.e. these people should be treated as slaves, they should be held in captivity because they are biologically inferior. And you have the ideology of race, the idea of race, coinciding with the economic subjugation of black people. But most importantly, in the UK, is the notion of race at home, the idea that people, working class people in the growing cities in the 19th century, they're of a different race. And often today we obviously think about race as something that's determined by colour. But really in the 19th century, the really big debates about race was the race of people living in the cities, the working classes, the Irish immigrants, people of the same colour. But the concern was that, you know, this is a large population of people who are coming to the cities who seem to be morally depraved. They're illiterate, they're prone to crime, they don't even stay within nuclear families, they're prone to prostitution, alcoholism. This picture on the left, which you probably know, is William Hogarth's Gin Lane, or the classic bourgeois fear of the working classes. And the way in which this anxiety was often expressed was these people must be somehow biologically inferior. In a society as rich as ours, as progressive, as able to produce so many scientific innovations and developments, how can it be that we have so many poor, illiterate, uneducated people? Well, the reason must be because they're somehow biologically inferior. It was a very kind of common idea amongst the elites. When people were thinking about the working classes in East London, they were thinking of them as a race apart, even though by all other measures they looked had the same skin colour as the elite. And obviously the thing that really does shape ideas about race, and to some extent you could argue we're still living with the legacy of this, is the British Empire, the expansion of British interests abroad, and the domination of countries, India, Sri Lanka, Burma, the list goes on. And this is a picture of how the map would have looked in the 19th century, and you can see the pink, you can see that this was the kind of map that would have been displayed in British schools at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. And this was to reinforce this idea that Britain is a superior country, and in fact the domination of people in the colonies is justified by the fact that they are to some extent biologically and culturally inferior. So the importance of empire, as we all know, is really so crucial in terms of thinking about race. You can see here the point about racial superiority, obviously the kind of the general for the British Army who goes around thinking that he's superior, is a large aspect of feeling the kind of control of other countries. But also this picture of the Hottentot Venus, which is the body of an African woman, which was a site of curiosity for Victorian audiences. Because at the one point that it's also a sign of superiority, it's a feeling of confidence. It's also a way of expressing and making sense of some of the feelings of exotic otherness. The fact that these are people who seem primitive, they seem perhaps more in touch with their natural sexual instincts. And this was a sort of real fascination for the Victorian mindset. And the empire is both sees race as something that's far away on the other side of the world, but it's something that curiously has a real purchase at home. But broadly, there is an underpinning to this racial thinking, which is based on science, pseudoscience, biology, people who, from the working classes or abroad, the reason that they're in these inferior social positions is because they are somehow biologically inferior. And there are all sorts of theories in the 19th century to claim that there were different kinds of racial categories and the white Aryans were at the top. This was, you know, fairly common mainstream thinking. It wasn't anything to be ashamed or embarrassed about. And then, very rapidly in the 20th century, a number of different factors began to change that view. The first, probably the most influential, was the Holocaust. Because of the experience and the knowledge of what had happened in the concentration camps, of the horror, the logical conclusion of Nazi ideology, the idea of biological racial differences, of superiority between races, became deeply unfashionable. And around this time, in the sort of 1945, 1946, the UN started to fund academics who would argue that biological races did not exist. This was a kind of a Nazi ideology, a fascist ideology, the whole kind of spirit of empire based on domination. All this is incorrect, and the UN was very proactive in funding academics to do that. And at the same time, more women, more Jews were entering academia in Western countries. And so the idea of race slowly became dismantled, the intellectual basis of it became questioned. Other factors which are also important, the fact that after the Second World War, ideas about racial superiority couldn't really be sustained in a world where the empire was itself falling apart, where you have post-colonial movements and you have people demanding to be liberated from the yoke of subservience. So you have, again, another very political, very historical factor that's challenging the idea of race, which was so entrenched by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. At home, you have the same development, which is the working classes are demanding their own political votes, their own political rights. So again, it's very difficult to see these people as biologically inferior when they're demanding the same political equality as the bourgeoisie. So there's a kind of undermining of the idea of race, which is extremely important. So you have these various kind of historical shifts that take place, which start challenging the idea of biological superiority. And then the other major shift that happens in Britain, which is of relevance to East London, is the emergence of mass immigration. And this is the SS Empire Windrush, which was the boat brought over 491 Jamaicans in 1948. And this is seen as the landmark moment where Britain recognises and accepts that immigration to Britain from the colonies is now a fact of life. So for the first time, you have the people of the empire, who for so long had been in the distant, the faraway lands, being as exotic, this kind of other creature, the kind of the source of fantasies and longings and all sorts of kind of Victorian anxieties. For the first time, they're actually coming over to Britain, and they intend to live here. So immigration, in terms of statistics, 11,000 Afro-Caribbeans arrived in 1954, and it peaked to about 34,000 in 1962. So that particular wave from that country was around the late 50s, early 60s. Immigration from India peaked at 49,000 in 1961. And the prospects of these different immigrant groups varied quite a lot. There's a tendency sometimes when we think about immigration to assume that everybody fared in the same way, and that wasn't really the case. Some immigrants from India would have come over with perhaps a bit more education, a bit more capital to start their own businesses. Others would have come over with skills. Some Afro-Caribbeans might have come over with their families. They were more likely to come over with their families than, say, Indians, who were more likely to come over as single men first and then bring their families later. The economic prospects of these groups varied quite a lot, but at the same time, they all experienced the same problems in terms of racism, in terms of public reaction to their arrival. And lots of people don't really realise when you speak to them, because we're so used to the idea of border control, is it was relatively easy for a long time to move between countries. It was seen as perfectly right the people, the citizens of the former colonies, should have British passports, that they should have the right to stay here. And it was always quite difficult for MPs to argue in the 50s and 60s that immigration should be restricted, because there was a feeling that these were British citizens too. And many of the immigrants who originally came in the post-war period intended not to stay for a long time. The idea was that they would come in and out and the borders would be porous and they would be returning home to take money back to their family. But because of the increasing border controls, because of immigration laws, it actually made it harder for people to return home, because they feared that every time they would leave the country, it would be increasingly difficult to come back in. So the tendency was rather to bring their families over and to decide to settle here for life. And so what you have is, you have, by the 60s, a growth of mass immigration, generally to the cities. Generally, these people are obviously taking jobs in the post-war period. This is what they're coming for. And they're coming for a better quality of life. They're coming for opportunities. And for a long time, the government was inviting them. So you would see in India, and you see in parts of the West Indies, adverts from the British government inviting people to come over, saying there's work for you to do. And these immigrants would be working in the NHS. They'd be working in the public services. They'd be working in transport. Lots of immigrants who are also extremely well qualified, who were educated in their home countries, would come to Britain and find that they were not doing the kinds of jobs they'd expected. They were doing quite low-paid jobs, which they felt were slightly below their status, but in a way they took what they could. The fear about immigration from the public got heightened. There was an increasing anxiety, particularly from political quarters, that immigration was becoming a problem. We were being swamped by numbers. And what you have then is the development of immigration bills, restrictions for the immigrants coming in for the first time. So 1961, you have the Commonwealth Immigration Bill, which was pretty much supported by all the political parties. It wasn't contested much. And even in 1968, when Enoch Powell made his Rivers of Blood speech, even though it was kind of dismissed roundly by almost all politicians, he was sacked for making that speech because it was seen as so controversial and the language that he'd used had been very explosive. Ultimately, the idea that immigration needed to be stemmed was not contested. That was considered an acceptable thing to say. And by 1971, immigration for unskilled workers effectively ended. So it was increasingly difficult by that point to get into the country. And that's when you have you then have a push, actually, in the rise of asylum seekers, people trying to get in through other means. But immigration for unskilled workers, the idea that basically you can come here if you've got a pair of hands and you want to work, that's no longer really a possibility. But the hostility to immigrants, they're criminal, they're lazy, they're stealing our jobs, even though lots of them were doing jobs that were not being filled. And also, the rise in immigration was often at a time when factories were struggling to be as productive on the global market. So if you look at a place like Oldham in the northwest of England, which was a place of cotton production, was very much at the heart of the textile industry towards the end of the 19th century. By the kind of 1950s, 1960s, these factories are really struggling to be as economically productive and to compete on the world market. And so what happened is that instead of closing these factories, there was an attempt to kind of keep the factories working through the night, to have night shifts. So lots of immigrants were doing the jobs that working class people were very reluctant to do for very low pay. So there was obviously a kind of sense of resentment, both that immigrants were coming over and doing work that was traditionally the kind of work that white working class people would do. But at the same time, the injection of these immigrants was what was keeping the factories going. So there's a kind of contradictory effect there about how people perceive immigration and the effect that immigration had. But what's important about the anxiety about immigrants and about race in the 60s and 70s and 80s is that it doesn't have any more that language of biological superiority. It doesn't even have necessarily the language of superiority. So it's very different to the 19th century fears and anxieties. What you have is this discussion of cultural difference. These people are fundamentally different. They speak a different language. They have different ideas about family. They don't come to work on time. They're prone to criminality. All these stereotypes about what ethnic people are like, about what their culture is like. It's interesting, actually, if you look at the 1970s and 1980s, the cliche was that, you know, young black men were prone to violence, were angry, and there was something about their culture. And today, if you think about it, actually, the big anxiety is now about young Asian men. Back in the 1980s, it was young Asian men are sort of good family boys. They listen to their parents and they don't, you know, they go to school. And yet, you know, we have the same anxieties today about them. So those things change, those stereotypes change. But at the heart of it, there's this idea that there's something constant about their culture, and that's why they are the way they are. And with this anxiety come very concrete, very practical barriers to people of ethnic backgrounds doing well in society. There were colour bans earlier on, really, rather than later, but there were colour bans, so people not being allowed into hotels and bars. That was fairly common at one point. Jobs and housing discrimination. There were obviously areas where Asians or black people weren't welcome. There was a feeling that they shouldn't be taking jobs. And certainly in housing, which was really organised by the state, council housing, it was very common practice for local authorities to send Asian and ethnic people into, or black people into, certain kinds of council estates and not into the white council estates. A fear that if you mix them up, it would create tensions. And so there was a kind of de facto segregation already going on by decisions made by local authorities. And there were all the problems that are generally associated with the cities, which also impacted on ethnic minorities. So general economic decline, lack of jobs, poor housing and so on. Coupled with media scares, police brutality, which was particularly common in East London. There were lots of cases of people being arrested on the streets on very dubious circumstances and then being treated very badly by the police. The accumulation of all these different things means that many immigrants at the time became disillusioned with the mother country. And so the consequence of this feeling of disenfranchisement, the feeling of resentment against the society in which they lived, the kind of common outburst was race riots. And in Toxteth, in Liverpool, in Brixton, in London, in Harmonsworth, in Birmingham, you get the explosion, the spontaneous eruption of violence, usually directed against the police. Again, immigrants are then therefore associated with destruction, disorder, and the instability of cities. But what you get at the same time is, as well as this violence, this feeling of almost anarchic kind of kick against the system, you also have a much more politically organised anti-racism movement. When the first immigrants came over in the 50s and 60s, they tended to set up welfare associations, so organisations that would help people fill out immigration forms or learn about what their rights were, kind of like a citizens' advice bureau. And that was the first generation of self-support for immigrants. When the second generation, which was growing up in Britain, came to maturity, they began to feel that they were much more angry, much more demanding about what their rights were. They didn't want simply to be kind of keeping themselves to themselves. And they organised. This is actually a demonstration, I think, in East London. But you would have the protests demanding equality in housing, equality in jobs. You know, we should be treated like everyone else. We shouldn't be treated as different because of our ethnic background, because of our immigrants. We're British. We're equal. We're citizens of this country. We should have the same rights. And you get the development of the notion of being politically black. So it doesn't matter what your cultural identity was, what your ethnic background was. The point is you're united by your experience of racism, but your political view, the view that you should all be equal. And in fact, you would get in the 70s and 80s the kind of almost comical situation where white people would say, I'm politically black, you know, because effectively you were showing solidarity. It was the idea that you believed in. It wasn't about being born black or being, you know, talking black or anything like that. It was about believing in a commitment to equality. In the 80s, you also get a kind of a shift in anti-racism, a growing interest in the idea that, well, it's not simply about being the same or about being treated the same or being treated equally. It's also about celebrating what being black is. For so long, when you have kind of media scares about immigration, you have anxieties about cultural difference. Well, maybe cultural difference isn't something to be afraid of. Maybe we should celebrate that. So you have the growth of things like black power and the fascination of cultural identity and political anti-racism begins to become more interested, not simply in the old political questions of housing or jobs or immigration. It starts becoming interested in things like celebrating cultural forms, like particular forms of black music, the picture of Bob Marley. So Rastafarianism starts to grow as an identity that people want to take on. The 70s in particular, the growth of Afro hair, the kind of let's celebrate being black and being natural. So kind of growing interest in the idea of black culture being something to celebrate, being different, being a bit subversive. And out of that interest in culture, you have the development of culturally specific or ethnically specific political groups. You start getting an increasingly strong identification from the second generation people of ethnic backgrounds with their cultural identity. So it's no longer a case about being politically black. It's about being Asian or being West Indian or being Muslim, is increasingly the case. And this is a picture of the Salman Rushdie book burning, Salman Rushdie Satanic Verses, which took place in Bradford. It's actually the 20th anniversary of that this year. But what you have at this time is this development of a new political demand, which is the demand to be different, the demand to be respected for one's culture and one's difference. And you have, in this period as well, the growth of religious organisations, like Muslim organisations, lobbying for things like halal food in schools. You know, this idea that political equality is about difference and about being recognised as difference. And one of the things that encourages this is the fact that political parties in local areas also try to connect with these religious and ethnic groups. There's a feeling that, okay, around this time, 1980s, 1990s, politics is starting to become a bit unfashionable. It's starting to feel like the working classes are no longer as active as they once were. But the groups that are really active, that are beginning to be coming onto the scene, are the Muslim groups and the ethnic groups and the community leaders. And so what you get around this time is political parties, particularly the Labour Party, thinking, well, how can we connect with these voters, with this constituency? And in Tower Hamlets, this was very much the case, that you would get the Bangladeshi vote, you would get the Bangladeshi community leaders who were not themselves elected, but the idea that they could effectively trade with the Labour Party and deliver a Bangladeshi vote. So whilst you have this kind of the emergence of cultural identity as a kind of a thing that people are interested in, you also get a political interest in it from the formal political parties. So there are lots of things that are driving and pushing this. So I've described this shift in the 1980s from the kind of the political demands of anti-racism, from equality, to increasing interest in cultural identity. And what I've described here is from assimilation to multiculturalism, which is effectively this idea of equality, so this idea that everyone should be treated differently because of their cultural differences. It's not fair, it's not right to treat people or assume they should have the same rights or even the same aspirations because everyone's shaped differently by their culture. Muslims want different things to Afro-Caribbeans, Hindus want different things to Sikhs, and this becomes the language, the official language and discourse of anti-racism. This becomes the way in which officials start to think about communities in their area, rather than thinking about a general constituency of people who might want better housing or better jobs. You start thinking of them in terms of these silos, these different communities, the Bangladeshi community in East London, oh well, they're different to the Jews, they're different to the white working class and so on. And we have to talk to them differently. In some cases, we even have to get Bangladeshi people to represent Bangladeshis because only really Bangladeshis know what other Bangladeshis want. That becomes quite a common sort of cliche of 1990s local politics. And then importantly, in 1999, you have a real watershed moment, which is the point at which official racism, the endorsement of racism in public, really becomes slammed down. It's impossible then, because of this idea of institutional racism, which was popularised by the McPherson Report into the murder of Stephen Lawrence. The importance of that McPherson Report is that it signals a new moment in British society where what would have passed for, you know, acceptable racism, what would have happened, you know, generally in private conversation, was now no longer considered acceptable. There was a kind of moral outrage that racism could exist. So here just a couple of pictures to illustrate that racism is far less publicly acceptable, which is a good thing. Just a picture here of the Sun's front page. If you remember the after the Big Brother Shilpa Shetty story, there was the big public outcry about the fact that Jay Goody had made this racist comment. What was interesting is that The Sun, which had for so long been decried by liberals as being the absolute racist paper, anti-immigration, very hostile to ethnic minorities, The Sun came out and said, what do we all have in common? So even The Sun, which is the ultimate tabloid newspaper, says that, you know, racism is a bad thing. So, you know, that's a sign that our society is really anti-racism. We have here a picture of David Cameron being hugged in the street by a black guy, a young black guy. Again, seen as a moment as, you know, the nasty Tory party who are so anti-immigrants. Look, even they care about ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of, you know, examples that you get of today. It's just unacceptable to talk about in racist terms. Really, you wouldn't expect a politician to survive very long if he tried. But whilst that's a good thing, and I think we should be, you know, pleased that anti-racism had that effect in our society, I think there are also potentially some new issues or new problems that have been brought up. And the first is this idea that in the emphasis on difference, and the emphasis on saying that everyone is different, they have different aspirations, could it be that we are unable anymore to assert that there are some common values or some common aspirations? And I don't mean by that everybody wants to, you know, has to eat or drink or has, you know, wants shelter. Those are very basic values. And I don't mean that we're all nice people. I mean that the ideas, the values of, say, the 1980s politics of equality, that, you know, that was a value that was universal, that was worth holding on to. Even though biological race is a discredited idea now, we still think about cultural difference. We still assume that cultural difference is a reason to treat people differently. So there has been a massive expansion since the election of Labour in 97 in official policy for targets, for positive action. The field that I know best is arts policy. And if you work in the arts or if you've ever tried to get funding from the Arts Council, they will ask you, you know, which ethnic communities are you trying to reach to? They have a fund of money that's given to black and minority ethnic artists on the basis that for some reason their art is black or their art somehow represents or serves a particular ethnic community. So this idea that black people don't make art, they make culture. What I see is quite patronising attitude about race and difference, which, you know, see as a kind of new racism, really, is now taken as a kind of good morally thing to do. So I think these are some problems that are worth thinking about in this climate that we're in. If there is a crisis of common values, if we're emphasising difference the whole time, could it be that that difference is a bit divisive? And here are just two examples of this. The first is the riot in Lascelles, which is a district in Birmingham, where you had young Afro-Caribbean boys fighting young Asian boys. Now, what's interesting about Lascelles is that about a decade or two decades earlier, those young Asian and Afro-Caribbean boys were united together to be fighting the police, whereas today they're fighting each other. And one of the arguments is that one of the reasons that they have become so divided amongst themselves is that through years of multicultural policies, through funding community leaders, different community centres, basically by telling people that they're so culturally different, they should celebrate their cultural difference, they'd actually forgotten how much they had in common. And rather than seeing their common problems coming out of the kind of same social sort of situation, they started to see each other as a source of their problems. And, you know, Lascelles is probably a good example of where politics of difference can be divisive and quite explosive. This is another image of the town of Oldham during the Night of Its Rights in 2001. And see here, a similar problem. This was Asian boys fighting the police, but what happened after the Oldham riots was the government did its own investigation. It found that Asian and white people felt very disconnected from each other in this town. They felt that they were not really part of the same community. They lived parallel lives, and that perhaps this had been one of the reasons that there was a sense of tension and anger against authorities, that, you know, the feeling that other communities are doing better than we are. And could it be that then, if you live in a society where there aren't any common values, where you feel disconnected from other people, could it be that you are looking for new sources of identity, that you don't want to be British anymore because that's very discredited and that's associated with empire, but you no longer believe in the idea of political equality and the old sort of 1980s left-wing or even right-wing ideas, that politics itself is no longer worthwhile, that you start looking to your cultural background, your ethnicity or your religion as a way of making sense of your relationship to the world. And here, this is actually a picture of two women on the streets of East London in Tower Hamlets. What's interesting is that when I was growing up in the 1980s, it would have been inconceivable for Muslim girls to walk around with a headscarf, never mind even a veil, whereas actually it's increasingly common now. And a lot of people mistakenly think, well, it's because of the importance of religion, or, you know, parents are telling their daughters to wear this. And really, it's almost like a kind of a desire to express oneself in a new identity. So in the way that perhaps a Che Guevara T-shirt or even a Marcus Garvey or a Bob Marley T-shirt in the 1980s would have been an expression of, you know, your radicalism. Today, what's radical is to find some comfort in your religion or in your kind of distinct cultural community. And obviously, there are some anxieties about whether this is more divisive, if it's actually excluding other people rather than bringing people together. If you have a society which is tiptoeing around different cultural sensitivities, then you have more and more debates about political correctness, about free speech. This is a picture that was taken in East London of a group of protesters about the film of the book Brick Lane by Monica Ali. And actually, it was a very small group of people who protested, but they, for some reason, they were very effective because they weren't allowed to film here. And their argument was, this portrays Bangladeshis, it portrays Muslims in a bad light. You see this again and again in society, that groups protest and say, this is offensive, it's an insult to my identity. And for equality's sake, we shouldn't have people arguing against each other and criticising each other's cultural beliefs. But at the same time, I'm rather optimistic. I think that we might have this sense of division, we might have this anxiety about not saying things that are offensive, but at the same time, there are lots of signs that Britain is not particularly divided. I only use this picture to show there are lots of examples where immigrants do integrate, they do, you know, feel perfectly home, they naturally take on cultural traits that are seen as British, and at the same time, British people take on the traits that are seen as very ethnic. There's a lot more cultural intermixing than sometimes people would think, and lots of intermarriage. Things that would suggest that, in fact, even though we have a lot of anxiety about racism and we have a lot of anxiety about, you know, not offending, in general, we don't just see each other as members of categories or ethnic groups. We do see each other as human beings, and we transcend those limited categories. And so finally, where are we now? I think that what's interesting is that there is now this big anxiety about difference, and there's almost a backlash against multiculturalism. And what Gordon Brown has argued is that we need Britishness on the agenda. We need to find these common values. But unfortunately, I think the way that they're going about it is a bit misguided, because you can't impose from the top Britishness. You can't tell people, well, this is what it is to be a citizen and you have to pass this test in order to be like that. The point is that ideas, common values, identities are things that do develop organically out of people's real lived experiences. And so we have to work out, you know, what would it mean to be, to have solidarity today? What would be our common values now? And I don't think it's clear. I don't think it's something that you can do through a focus group. You can imagine, you know, any idea that Gordon Brown has of Britishness is probably entirely irrelevant to the people of East London. So I suppose the point is to start here and now in the streets and the people that we meet, and to work out from those relationships rather than to try and come up with an abstract set of ideas to define it. Yes, and I think I will leave it on that note.
This audio pod was produced by WorldRight's London Behind the Scenes programme. For further audio and video pods from the series, and for more information about WorldRight's other projects, please go to www.worldrights.org.uk.